From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Benny Gantz, the opposition leader in the Israeli elections, has officially conceded, which means Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is set to win a fifth term despite both parties winning the same number of seats. Netanyahu's coalition is stronger. This would make Netanyahu the longest-serving prime minister in Israel's history. President Trump has already called to congratulate him. Here Trump is speaking to reporters today.
He's been a great ally, and he's a friend. I'd like to congratulate him. That was a well-thought-out race, I can tell you. But it looks like Bibi has won that race.
Joining us now is Neri Zilber, journalist and adjunct fellow of the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. He's in Tel Aviv. Hi, Neri.
Hi, Jeremy. Good to be with you again.
Well, what is the big takeaway for you of this election, and how are voters feeling today?
Well, I think undoubtedly the big takeaway is that Netanyahu has done it again. After a hard-fought and very nasty campaign in many respects, and a closer campaign than many expected at the outset, Bibi won again. Now, as you mentioned, for a fifth term, 10 years straight in office, and going to be, come this summer, the longest ever serving Israeli prime minister. And voters, it depends what side of the political spectrum you're on. The country is very much divided between right and left. So the right-wing voters are very happy that their guy won again and that things will remain the same more or less going forward. And obviously the left-wing bloc bitterly disappointed, on the verge of inconsolable in many respects.
How much did Netanyahu's victory here have to do with his very cozy relationship with President Trump?
I think it played a big role. Trump was front and center in many of Netanyahu's social media videos, billboards, and even his statements. What the message he was relaying to the Israeli public was that I have a very close personal relationship with the U.S. president. We're personal friends. But not only President Trump, also various other world leaders like Vladimir Putin and the Brazilian president and Modi in India, who in one form or another played a role in this campaign. And that was part of Netanyahu's overall message. Not untrue in many respects, we should say, that Netanyahu is a leader internationally recognized, has sway, and that played in his favor.
Now, Netanyahu faces a pending criminal indictment on bribery and fraud charges by Israel's attorney general. That could come pretty soon. How great of a threat would that be to him?
So that's the key upcoming question. So Netanyahu will be forming the next government. I think that's almost certain. The question is how long this government is able to last for. So he has a hearing in July, and then I think ultimately the attorney general's decision will come a few months after that. So in theory, the government may only last a few months, and it all depends really on whether Netanyahu can convince his other coalition partners, arguably all of them from the right to the far right, that will be in his new coalition, to stay with him after the hearing, and despite the fact that the attorney general, in all likelihood, will move forward with charges and ultimately a trial. So that's less about politics per se. It's more about the legal process and how that impacts the politics going forward.
And he's trying to get a law passed in order to make it so that a sitting prime minister doesn't have to deal with an indictment.
Correct. So by law, a sitting prime minister, even if he's indicted, doesn't have to resign. He can stay in office until the entire legal process, up to including appeals to the Supreme Court, are exhausted. Now, that's never quite been put to the test because no sitting prime minister has ever been indicted. Previous ones who have faced legal troubles have had the good sense to step down. But Netanyahu very clearly wants to keep fighting, and so he's going to try to pass this law, as you mentioned, to shield him from prosecution, even retroactively, which very much wouldn't be constitutional. So he would also arguably have to pass another law bypassing decisions of the Supreme Court. All very tricky legally and politically, but he's going to go for it and try to convince his new coalition partners that he's the man to stay in power. And he might offer them something that they can't refuse, which would possibly be annexation of the West Bank. And that itself would have real repercussions on the ground here, I believe.
Meanwhile, Neri, we remember that President Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, was tasked with, among other things, bringing peace to the Middle East between the Israelis and the Palestinians. That hasn't happened yet. But do you think that there's going to be any push on that now that Netanyahu has secured a fifth term, it looks like?
Well, we don't quite know. The speculation, at least until recently, was that they were going to put forward this plan after the Israeli election, even as soon as a week or two afterwards. Now we're hearing that it might be early summer. But there are two competing interests here. There's the Trump peace plan, whatever it has in it, we don't quite know. On the one hand, if it's genuine in its intent to move forward on some kind of peace process, that's one thing. But then you have the Netanyahu's legal troubles that we mentioned, which are kind of moving Netanyahu and his future government into something like annexation, which would be very, I think, counterproductive to any form of peace, any idea of a two-state solution. So you have these two competing interests, and I think when it comes down to it, Netanyahu will likely choose his own personal and legal survival over any strange attempt to move forward in this current environment with any kind of peace process.
That is Neri Zilber, a journalist and adjunct fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, joining us from Tel Aviv. Neri, thank you.
My pleasure, Jeremy.
Well, we now know that the three Marines killed in that deadly attack in Afghanistan on Monday were from a regiment based at Fort Devens in Massachusetts. We also know their deaths will bring home once again what troops are facing, both in combat and remembering it. According to a 2018 Veterans Affairs survey, nearly 16% of all troops deployed to Afghanistan and Iraq have screened positive for post-traumatic stress disorder. A clinic at the University of Central Florida is now treating some of them, veterans and active service members, with PTSD by using virtual reality. As American Homefront reporter Stephanie Colombini tells us, the military wants to expand this therapy to more patients.
Imagine you're walking through a village in a war zone in Iraq. Suddenly, a bomb explodes. Guns are firing. Children are crying. The distinct smells of diesel fuel and burning flesh waft through the air as the ground rumbles beneath your feet. It's all very disturbing. Except this isn't an Iraqi village. It's a therapist's office at the University of Central Florida. The clinic has been using virtual reality as part of an exposure therapy program to treat PTSD in combat veterans since 2010. Deborah Bidell is the clinic director. She says many patients struggle with everyday tasks like shopping or going to the gas station.
We never, ever think that people's traumatic memories are going to go away. But what we want to do is dislocate those triggers from the anxiety so that from now on, a person could smell diesel fuel and not worry that an IED is going to explode and their best friend is going to be killed.
38-year-old Kevin Turgliaferra is an Army National Guard veteran and served in Afghanistan. He's battled anger and manic depression and says it was damaging his relationship with his family.
Where I'd get aggravated with the kids, or I wouldn't want to engage with the kids because I'm too on edge when we go somewhere. Anything outside my little comfort zone was a no-go.
Turgliaferra participated in UCF's three-week intensive treatment program. Every day, he put on virtual reality goggles and watched scenes that reflected his personal experience. Besides visuals, therapist Keith Smith also uses sounds and scents, like smoke and gunfire. There's even a platform under the chair that vibrates.
We tell the patients initially that this is going to be a very uncomfortable process. So as a therapist, while I'll be looking for signs of physical arousal, shaking, teary-eyed, you know, muscle tension, those type of things.
Smith says patients get calmer with each session and reveal more details about their trauma. Turgliaferra says he was shocked to find himself opening up.
The layers, they just peel back and they get you to your core. It's like, really? Come on, you know? At first, it's like you don't want to, but you break down and do it, and it's absolutely amazing.
Patients are in the clinic all day for 3 weeks. They also take part in group therapy and learn techniques to avoid relapse. Smith says part of the treatment involves taking off the goggles and walking around places they may have previously avoided, like the crowded UCF campus.
And learning that they can tolerate that distress and learning that, hey, I may not feel comfortable, but I can do this.
A study the clinic conducted with about 100 patients found two-thirds of them no longer had PTSD once they completed the program. The staff now is developing new software that can create more scenarios to fit patients' personal experiences. Deborah Bidell cites a Marine who came to the clinic and struggled to respond to a scene with men wearing Army uniforms.
It's distracting because I keep looking at that guy next to me and going, that's the wrong uniform. So we have to get to that level of detail, and our new VR tool will allow us to do that.
The Department of Defense is also paying the clinic to create virtual reality programs at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, Fort Gordon, Georgia, and the Naval Medical Center in Portsmouth, Virginia. The goal is to bring the technology to more active duty personnel and study whether the therapy affects them differently if they receive it on the bases where they live. For Here and Now, I'm Stephanie Colombini.
Well, we want to take a moment now to note a milestone in astronomy.
We've been studying black holes so long that sometimes it's easy to forget that none of us has actually seen one.
Until now. That was National Science Foundation Director France Cordova announcing the release today of the first direct image of a black hole. You can check it out on the Here and Now Facebook page.
Leaving the White House this morning, President Trump said despite Democrats' demands, he will not release his tax returns.
I would love to give them, but I'm not going to do it while I'm under audit. It's very simple. Remember, I got elected last time, the same exact issue.
But yesterday, IRS Commissioner Charles Rettig reiterated there is no rule prohibiting someone under audit from releasing returns. Also this morning, the president harshly criticized the Mueller-Russia investigation, even though he praised it after the Barr summary. And, oh yeah, who's running the Homeland Security? Lots to get to with our political strategists. This week, they include Alice Stewart, the Republican strategist. Hi, Alice.
Hi, Robin. Great to be here.
And great to talk to you. And Bill Press, the Democratic host of the Bill Press radio show. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Robin. Good to be here.
And I want to start with both of you with listening to a little of the president today on the Mueller investigation.
This was an attempted coup. This was an attempted takedown of a president. And we beat them. We beat them. So the Mueller report, when they talk about obstruction, what we fight back. And you know why we fight back? Because I knew how illegal this whole thing was. It was a scam.
Alice, a coup? Now, I just want to back up. A U.S. intelligence was already investigating Russian election interference because of what the Russians were doing in 2016 on social media and elsewhere. Then Trump aide George Papadopoulos bragged that he'd gotten word of dirt on Hillary Clinton from a Russian. That took them to the Trump campaign. Is coup a word, Alice, you would recommend?
No, but okay. Often we lose sight of the fact that this really should focus on where it started, which is Russian interference in our election and possibly influencing the outcome of the election. However, Bill Barr is someone that has a tremendous reputation, and I have a hard time believing that he would come out and say, as he did today, that he believes spying did occur on the Trump campaign in 2016 if it didn't happen. So the questions and the call for looking into the origins of how the probe with regard to the Trump campaign and this administration began is worth having. There may be nothing that comes of it, but I think these are questions that do need to be looked at.
Well, let's listen, Bill, before you jump in. Let's listen to Bill Barr, again, Attorney General Bill Barr, saying today he's going to investigate the investigations into the Trump campaign. He was at a Senate hearing, and here he is with New Hampshire Democrat Gene Shaheen.
And I'm not talking about the FBI necessarily, but intelligence agencies more broadly.
So you're not suggesting, though, that spying occurred?
I don't. I guess you could. I think there's spying did occur. Yes, I think spying did occur.
Now, Bill Press, he went on to say, I'm not sure if it was predicated on anything, but he thinks it did. So your thoughts on hearing that today?
Well, first of all, I don't know whether he's talking about people were spying on the Trump campaign or the Trumpers were spying on other people. He didn't make that clear. I think that's still to be decided. Look, I want to agree with Alice on one point. What we lose track of, first, let me back up. We have not seen the Mueller report. Anybody who talks about the Mueller report is talking hot air, including the President of the United States. All we've seen is a four-page summary, point number one. But we do know that the Mueller report established something really fundamental, which is there was an attack on the United States, an attack by a foreign adversary to undo our election in order to help Donald Trump get elected. And that is a fact which Robert Mueller established definitively, a fact that the President of the United States has yet to acknowledge, let alone condemn. So whatever else is in the Mueller report, I think we have to appreciate that. Now, it's not over yet. We saw there's still going investigations going on in New York. We still know what's going to happen to Roger Stone. We still know what's going to happen really to Michael Flynn or to Paul Manafort. And one day we're going to see the report, just like Robin, we're going to see the president's tax return.
Well, what about the change in tone, Alice, the president's change in tone on the report? He was crowing after the Barr summary that he had been fully exonerated. He hadn't. I mean, he had been exonerated on a campaign collusion, but there was not enough evidence, according to Mueller, on the obstruction of judges. Obstruction of justice. Barr concluded that there wasn't enough evidence. But why suddenly now calling it a coup? What do you think is going on here?
I don't believe the president's thought about the Mueller report has changed so much as where he wants to focus. He clearly still believes that this will show that they did not conspire or coordinate with the Russian government with regard to election interference activities. And that is something that they should take note of and certainly take comfort in, as well as the American people. However, we're past the point of what's in the Mueller report. We will wait and see what's in there. But there are legitimate questions as to how the oversight process began. I think Adam Schiff needs to be cautious as to what his motives are and some light being shined on that. So there's going to be a lot that will be uncovered, and I think these are valid concerns. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, you know, Robin, I think in a way the president can't take yes for an answer. Mm. If I were him and that four-page summary had come out, I would have said it proves what I've been saying all along and then move on. He can't let
But the Barr is saying that he's going to have at least the redacted version within the week, and there is speculation that perhaps there is fear in the White House of what we're now going to see when that comes out. But I do want to move on to immigration. And Bill Press, I want to ask you, if you are one of the Democrats calling for Donald Trump's hardline 33-year-old aide, Stephen Miller, to be made Homeland Security Secretary after Kirstjen Nielsen was jettisoned on Sunday, because people feel that he's running the show anyway. Are you one who says, why not just make him visible?
Well, they might as well, because he's running the agency. I think that's pretty clear. Kirstjen Nielsen is out now. The deputy secretary is out as of yesterday. The general counsel is reportedly on his way out. So is the head of just about anybody who is around Kirstjen Nielsen, including the head of the Secret Service. So Stephen Miller, I believe, is running the agency. But Robin, that's not my strategy. You know what my strategy is? Rule number one in politics, when the other team is making a total mess of it themselves and screwing up so badly, stay out of the way. Just let them do it.
Well, you know what? I'm going to ask you about that, if Democrats maybe shouldn't be doing that because lives are at stake. But, Alice, I do want to ask you about Stephen Miller first. And before we do that, let's listen to the president when he was asked about this very thing.
He's a wonderful person. People don't know him. He's a wonderful – been with me from the beginning. He's a brilliant man. And, frankly, there's only one person that's running it. You know who that is? It's me.
Alice, your thoughts?
That's exactly 100% true. The Oz behind the curtain is Donald Trump. The Oz in front of the curtain is Donald Trump. So
you know what you're saying, right? Because the Wizard of Oz was a complete flim-flam man.
is that Bill's saying that Stephen Miller is calling all the shots at Homeland Security. President Trump is the person that is executing his policies, and there is not one single thing wrong with him wanting to get the right people in the right place to continue executing his policies.
But, Alice, you would have to agree that Stephen Miller is the most persuasive, most prominent voice with Donald Trump on this issue, and he's following Stephen Miller's advice.
Stephen Miller has had tremendous influence on this president with regard to immigration, but the president was hard line on securing the border and immigration well before Stephen Miller came into the picture. Mm-hmm. And Stephen Miller's policies and his ideas reflect what the president's are. But to say that he's certainly the one calling all the shots is just not true.
Well, Robin, if I can, very quickly.
I do want to take you off on something you said. Go ahead.
Okay. Very quickly. I think what we're losing sight of here is there were more people that across the border tried to last month than in 10 years, which I think we're losing sight of the fact that despite all of his tough rhetoric and all of his actions, Donald Trump's policies are not working.
Well, but should Democrats be doing more? Let's say, should Democrats be doing more? They have some muscle now in Congress. Should they be calling for more judges to process migrants, more detention centers? Should they be calling for more to be done in the countries that they are fleeing?
Well, this may be heretical. Here's what I would say. They ought to go back to George W. Bush's comprehensive immigration reform, which passed the Senate that wouldn't pass the Republican-controlled House at the time, and get together on that legislation, a comprehensive approach to it, which would include more asylum judges and other things, but not just closing the border.
Okay.
The president has been quite clear on several options that would work, and putting an end to the Democrats' catch-and-release program is key to that. And also, I have always supported his commitment to ending certainly catch and release, chain migration, the visa lottery. All these are areas dealing with immigration that can be addressed. And his big, beautiful wall is something that he certainly wants to execute, but there are many other ways we need to go about doing it,
Alice,
and that's what he's pushing for.
We only have a minute left. I'm going to give it to you. Why isn't Treasury Secretary Mnuchin releasing the president's tax returns, given that there was a 1924 law saying that when Treasury is asked, they shall do it?
Because the president does not want people to see his tax returns. Look, I was a Republican challenger against the president, and we fought hard to have that information out there. I think the American people should see access to this, but this is something he's committed to. It will never happen. Let's just take note of the fact that we have seen a black hole before we've seen the president's tax returns, and that's going to be something that will never happen.
And the question is, why doesn't the president want us to see his tax returns?
It's been the question for 3 years now. Bill Press, the Democrat who hosts the Bill Press radio show. We will take it up again, I'm sure. Alice Stewart, the Republican strategist. I want to thank you both. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Robin.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Ember Wave. Ember Wave, the revolutionary personal thermostat that is designed to help you feel cooler or warmer at the press of a button. Ember Wave can put you in control in places like your freezing office, uncomfortable airplanes, restaurants, trains, cafes, and more. Named one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018, learn more at emberwave.com and use code NPR to save $50 at checkout. Ember Wave, control your comfort.
Today, Delta announced a nearly 30% increase in profits for the latest quarter over this time last year. Delta CEO Ed Bastian had this to say on CNBC.
Demand was really strong. We had top line growth of 7.5% in the quarter, our highest revenues in the March quarter in our history. And as you know, March is typically our seasonally weakest quarter, so we feel very good about that.
Joining us now is Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Hi, Seth.
Hi, Jeremy.
And what's behind these good numbers for Delta?
Well, you've got the broader strong economy. That means people are flying more. They're paying more for airline tickets when they fly. Well, at the same time, jet fuel prices are roughly the same as where they were a year ago. So when you have people paying more, but an airline not spending a lot more, that's helpful. That's helpful for all airlines. But then Delta in particular, you know, a few days ago, what's called the airline quality ratings came out and said Delta's the top airline in America based on rankings like punctuality, not losing very many bags, not getting very many customer complaints. And in an industry that's kind of commoditized where, you know, it costs Delta about the same as it does American or United to carry a passenger. If your costs are similar and if people are willing to pay more to fly you because they like you a little better, that can add up to big problems. Profits. There's more than one way to make money in the airline industry. I mean, you know, Spirit makes a lot of money too, but Delta certainly has figured out a way. And as you heard in that soundbite from Ed Bastian, they've taken some of the seasonality out of the business. That winter quarter, airlines used to hope just not lose money. Now they're making big money.
And Delta, by the way, does not have any 737 MAX jets in its fleets, unlike American and Southwest. Why doesn't Delta have those? And did that help them?
Yeah, I mean, they're surely glad right now to not have them. Of course, they didn't know what was going to happen. There's a lot of luck involved there. Partly, though, Delta does tend to have a philosophy of not being a first mover, not going first when it comes to new aircraft programs. And that, in this case, certainly helped it.
Meanwhile, Seth, we are waiting for an announcement today from JetBlue. What are we hoping to find out?
Seems to be the worst kept secret in the airline industry. I mean, all they said is they're going to have this big event for employees. But everybody who watches this airline believes that they are going to announce transatlantic service for the first time, flying from somewhere in the U.S. to somewhere in Europe. They've made a bunch of, if you're kind of paying attention, regulatory filings that, you know, that indicate they're interested. And they've said in the past that they're interested in doing that. So most of us think that's what's going to happen today.
Now, why would a carrier like JetBlue want to launch transatlantic service when we just saw WOW Air, the low-cost Icelandic airline, go out of business, as you've told us many times, because they launched their transatlantic service and they just couldn't support it?
Yeah, it's a tough business to get into. For JetBlue, there's a lot less risk here. This is a rather big airline, you know, 250 airplanes. And, you know, we'll have to see here, assuming they do in fact say that this is what they're going to do, what their precise plans are. But they're not betting the airline on this. And if they do it, it's not going to be so different from a lot of what they're already doing. I mean, they fly from, you know, New York to Los Angeles. Where they have live flat premium seats already there. And so to, you know, just kind of turn and go the other way, fly to, you know, London, Amsterdam, wherever, from a place like New York, you know, Boston, another big base for them, where the planes that they're rather clearly interested in getting can reach, wouldn't be such a big departure.
That is Seth Kaplan, Here Now transportation analyst. Seth, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Okay, it's time for us to take our weekly break from the news and get to some music and another edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
And there goes the last DJ.
Chris DeRitas is a DJ at KCRW in Santa Monica, California. He joins us now. Hi, Chris.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing well. And let's get right to some of the music that you brought us.
Sure.
This is called 1,000 Words. It's by 017. What to say, how are you so far away? Is it sunny? The sun just went down. I thought about you. Days drag slowly when it swarms softly running. Ice creams onto the soil. We kicked up all about. Seems like all one moment motionless. I think about you walking through the door quickly smiling. Your hand on the handle, fingers curled and closing. Other hand to my hair, I have to go. So much time dragging slowly. Nights asleep, I'll try to dream of you. Nights asleep, I'll try to dream of you. Nights asleep, I'll try to dream of you. Nights asleep, I'll... That is using the computer voice in a way I have never thought possible, but it's pretty cool.
Yeah, this is the only thing we have from this ensemble so far. They just put out a single and another one on the way, and it's so compelling because it has a familiarity to it too, like a bit of Daft Punk or Kraftwerk. Mm-hmm. But there's a freshness to it too.
And is that his voice?
That is his voice. Yeah, with a little auto tune.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, you know, they take their name 0171 from the old London, you know, the central London phone code. 0171 uh-huh. was one of the telephone codes. And it's no longer that, but you know, the older listeners who have made calls in London would know that number. Now it's 020. It's not quite as catchy.
Right, exactly. Everything's 0207, this, that, and the other thing in London.
Yeah, but they take this love of nostalgia and they kind of throw it into this modern context.
Okay, well, from the sounds of the modern world to another one that seems to be grabbing a piece of the zeitgeist, this is Billie Eilish. And before we play her music, you wanted us to listen to this.
My Invisalign has...
I have taken out my Invisalign.
I have taken out my Invisalign, and this is the album.
I love the way the album begins because they're so excited still that all of this is happening to them. It's just 2 years ago, everything was just a maybe. And now she's fast becoming the biggest artist in the world. And she starts the album by taking out her Invisalign.
Wow.
I mean, she's 17 years old.
And she's got a very popular Instagram account also. Let's hear the music. This is called Ilo Milo.
Remember not to get too close to stars. They're never gonna give you love like ours. Where did you go? I should know.
I can't even believe this is the same person that we just heard.
Right? The songs are so inventive, kind of taking another look at what a pop song from a young girl could be. You know, production-wise, it's her brother doing the production. Their work's really more closer to what's happening in progressive hip-hop. Lyrically, it's definitely not just the song, but the whole album is really parent-friendly, but it's still a really honest and unvarnished take on the horrors of emerging adulthood and first love experiences. You know, she's become a phenomenon. When she was 14, her older brother, Phineas, who co-writes the songs and produced the songs, he had a band. It was called The Slightlys, and he was mixing a song he had written for his band in his bedroom. And he was playing it over and over again, as you do, listening back to the mix. Mm-hmm. And Billy's bedroom shared a wall with his. And he goes into the kitchen at some point to fix a sandwich, and Billy's in there, and she's singing his song. You know, she learned it from hearing it over and over through the wall. And Phineas says to her, "Wow, you should sing this song." So they redid it with her singing it, and that was Ocean Eyes. And they posted that up on SoundCloud. The song blew up, and now she's just put out this debut album. And she still writes the songs with Phineas in their bedroom studio with Finn producing. They've got this North American tour that's sold out, and they're playing festivals throughout the summer, including Coachella. I mean, it's quite something to see, all happening in the last 2 years.
Yeah, that's amazing. Okay, the next one you wanted us to hear is called Mendocino. This is by Crane Like the Bird.
I love to swim out at night. Like a scene in Gattaca, he said nothing for the way back. It's like how you lived your life. So I surf in the more twilight to be there where you're at.
So, melancholy lyrics there, but not the sound.
Well, his lyrics are really taken with Northern California experiences that he's enjoyed in Northern California. The voice you might recognize, it's Luke Steele from Empire of the Sun. Hmm. You know, Daniel Lanois, the star producer, who's known mostly for his work with U2 and Peter Gabriel and Bob Dylan. Dan lives in Silver Lake, and that's an area in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And he was one day at a neighborhood club checking out a jazz combo, and he befriended the drummer. The drummer was Kyle Crane. And he took Kyle under his wing, put him on all these sessions, introduced him to a lot of amazing artists, and Kyle became this, you know, in-demand session player. But he's also a really talented songwriter and producer, and he starts building an album of songs that he's written and produced, and he reaches out to all these new contacts he's made, his favorite singers, to sing these songs. And the album just came out. It's kind of a who's who of cool contemporary left of center vocalists. James Mercer of The Shins, Connor Oberst is on here, Ben from Band of Horses, Peter of Peter, Bjorn, and John, and Sabine from Brazilian Girls. This is the track that features Luke Steele from Empire of the Sun.
And that is why you always have to put your phone down and talk to people, because you never know who you're going to collaborate with on your next project just from befriending the drummer. Okay, the next one that you wanted us to hear is called Have You Both. This is by Wild Bell.
Dreadlocks and you put a little face. Well, meet me at the gate, boy, meet me at the gate. Take me out to dinner when you get to LA. Well, I messaged the wrong kid on the internet. Yeah, it
it's an accident when you both play in a punk rock band and you both fell for the same woman.
Chris, this is such a window into the modern world today on the DJ Sessions. Now we're talking about accidentally messaging the wrong person on Facebook.
You know, I didn't come up with that theme when I put this all together, but you're right.
It worked out. Tell us about Wild Bell.
Well, Wild Bell is a Chicago brother-sister duo, Elliot and Natalie Bergman. You might know Elliot because he's the oldest, and he went off to University of Michigan, and he started an Afro beat band called Nomo, which did quite well. We were big fans at KCRW. And he wrote a song at some point for Nomo, and he had his sister sing it, and the band's reaction was like, this is a cool song, but it doesn't sound like Nomo. You guys should start your own project under another name with her. You know, and Bell is Natalie's middle name, so Wild Bell was born. The songs still feature Elliot on his wide-ranging collection of homemade instruments and his honking baritone sax, but the other constant here is Natalie's sultry vocals, and she's got this, you know, way of sitting on top of that authentic reggae-tinged beat that he produces.
Well, a lot of great music there today, and we will have it all at hereandnow.org, also on our Spotify playlist. Just search for NPR Here and Now, and we were on Apple Music as well. Chris DeRitas at KCRW in Santa Monica, thanks as always.
Jeremy, always good to talk to you.
Teen parents have now agreed to plead guilty in the college admissions scandal. Parents accused of paying to boost kids' test scores or getting them in as star athletes in sports many didn't even play. There are many casualties here. Kids who didn't know, who've lost trust in parents, shamed parents. One apologized to kids accepted through their own hard work. Another casualty, the downfall of a hometown hero. That's former Georgetown tennis coach Gordy Ernst, charged with taking more than $2.7 million in bribes to get 12 students in. He's pled not guilty, but if true, it's quite a fall. Bill Reynolds, longtime sports columnist at the Providence Journal, has been writing about the Gordy Ernst he and others rooted for when he was growing up in Cranston, one of three brothers. Bill, welcome.
Good to be here.
And I'd love for you to read from your column that just made us sit down hard. We know people who coached Gordy when he was a kid. He also briefly coached a colleague. If you could read just the first few paragraphs of your recent column.
Sure. Once upon a time, he was our local version of Chip Hilton, the great sports hero of the Claire B. novels that were written back there in the 1950s, about the kid who glided through the seasons as if always on smooth ice, all-state in hockey, all-state in tennis, and more important, he was a Providence Journal honor roll boy back there in the spring of 1985, the newspaper's annual award for the most well-rounded student-athlete in the state, the creme de la creme of all the boys who played sports in the Rhode Island Interscholastic League. And as former Journal sports writer Mike Shostak once wrote, Ernst was the golden boy of Rhode Island high school sports in the 80s. High praise indeed.
Yeah, quite something. And not just Gordy, his entire family.
Absolutely. He had a brother who was very good, not as good as Gordy, but certainly outstanding. His father was a kind of a local coaching legend, Dick Ernst Sr. Everyone knew who the Ernsts were, whether you actually knew them or not, you knew about them.
Yeah. And actually went on to play. He was drafted, played professional hockey?
Yes. Yeah. No, I mean, he was a superstar. And
yeah.
So when the news broke, it's like, I mean, it's shattering. I mean, it's a really very kind of symbolic loss in a certain sense.
Right. For a little state with
a big
heart for somebody like this. And you write that you and others followed him. You knew, for instance, when he went to teach Michelle Obama and the girls.
Well, I knew Gordy when he was a kid. He had to be a teenager, and he used to play on a court on the east side of Providence. And I used to kind of hang around the court. So I knew Gordy, you know, not real well, but I certainly knew him. And I also knew about him coaching Michelle Obama and the White House courts. And The story was one day Barack Obama comes out, and Gordy says something to him, some kind of like wisecrack. And Barack Obama, as the story goes, gave him a look like, knock it off, like you're not back in Rhode Island like a schoolyard.
Yeah. But as you're right, down-home Rhode Island personality could get along with anyone, as if pretentious was a word he never looked at, didn't know.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that's the thing about being kind of a basic Rhode Islander. No one knows what the word means, never mind being pretentious.
Yeah. How do you square this? And it's not just the arrest and the racketeering charges, but we're learning now that Georgetown found he violated university rules concerning admissions. He hadn't coached the tennis team since 2017. And in fact, he'd come home and he'd become the new women's coach at URI.
Right, right. He had bailed out of there. So they had to know something, and they wanted to get rid of him, because I'm sure he would not have left.
And that's got to be, I mean, I'm sure URI is saying, hey.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks a lot.
Look, he, innocent until proven guilty, but still arrested by federal agents for allegedly accepting $2.7 million in bribes. And not only, accepting the money, jeopardizing a sports program, allowing people through that weren't qualified.
No, it's a huge scandal. And I think making it worse, at least around here, was Gordy Ernst was the Journal Honor Roll Boy, which the Journal Bulletin is the state's newspaper, basically. And every year they pick a Rhode Island Honor Roll Boy and Girl, and they are symbolic of the best that we have that year in the state. So the question you ask, or as it floats around out there later, is this the kind of thing the Journal Honor Roll Boys do? And if it is, that's kind of sad. It kind of makes you wonder.
Well, also, for any hometown that watches someone go off to these heights, Brown, he was a Brown graduate, Lehman Brothers, before coaching at Penn, drafted in the 10th round of the NHL draft to play for the Minnesota North Stars out of high school. You know, you watch and you applaud. Are people taking it to heart like it somehow reflects on them?
That's a good question. But Gordy Ernst was a name when he was in high school that if you knew sports or followed sports or cared about sports at any level, you knew who he was. And he was the one, he was the one who carried a lot of hopes with him, I think.
Yeah. Well, he saw his father die, saw a brother die. You notice, I mean, it's just speculation, but has anybody come up with an answer to the questions? Why?
No, I have not heard anybody with an answer to the questions why.
Bill Reynolds, sports columnist at the Providence Journal. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.